in the crack, stack the sins of this world to his body and conquer evil and hell. Then stack the keys of death and one breath in the lock of cell. He rolls on a third, I'm telling you, find a residual fact, just like Toby Mac and Pony Soprano upon his track.
Hello out there in shortwave land. This is the Zeph Report, Channel Z. Zeph Daniel, your host. You got a pen handy? You want me to plug him in? Okay. You got a pen handy? All right. Let me lay on you that address one more time. Zeph Daniel or ZephNet at 5 Bisbee Court, 109 PMB, Paul Mary Baker, 16, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87508. All right, and I tried to do that at the top of the hour. You're listening to us on 9985 megahertz shortwave that's blasting out just ahead of Alex Jones on the next hour. You are hearing us live on the Internet, two streams, either 8K or, if you like, the big fat stereo 64K FM stream that we have. Also on satellite on the KU band. For those fanatics out in your motorhome somewhere, or you people that are trying to download us off the satellite, picking it up so you can put it into your markets and affiliates around the world. I understand that you play us down in Tasmania, and that's a pretty exotic location that I hope to visit one day. And basically, this is Geopolitical Day. This is our fourth year anniversary today for the Zeph Report, which I began a spiritual journey leading into the uncovering prophetically of all the geopolitical nonsense, and that's actually led to our guest today. You've heard our guest, Webster Griffin Tarpley. You have heard him, Jeff Rantz, Alex Jones. He did a State of the World there. He wrote the definitive book on the Bush family called The Unauthorized Biography, which he took a lot of heat from back in 1992. I have this book, and Trish and I are reading it and just delighted with his wit and prose. He is an iconoclast. He is a person that is not, apparently, if he played along, he'd probably have his own TV show right now on one of these, probably on CNN or something. I don't know, but he's going to talk to you right here. And this is this also goes out in the podcast. Hello out there in the podosphere. So this file that we're making right now in 64K stereo MP3 will be on the Internet forever, and you'll never get rid of it. And people will be downloading this for a long time. So without further ado, let me go ahead and bring our guest on, Webster Griffin Tarpley. Hello, sir.
Hello, Zeph. How are you?
Doing very well, but very concerned today about the geopolitical events with respect to Iran and all the things we see going on. And so we had to turn to you finally at this hour because a lot of us are confused. Some are saying that they're going to do something with this war. Other people say no. You gave a State of the World on the Alex Jones Show on January 30th, I believe, in which you stated that, you know, you believe this is imminent. And I've tried to give them a little bit of background about your articles or anywhere on the web. These two books are unbelievable. Also, the other one, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, came out in 2005. Again, it's a must for your library. You can get them. Well, where can they get the books? Let's start off with that.
Well, I think the easiest way to get them is to simply go to Amazon. You can buy the two of them on Amazon. You can buy 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, plus the 1992 Bush biography, the only critical biography of Bush and therefore of the founder of the dynasty and the family network. You can get all of that for less than $25, I think, and if you, since they have this super shipping, you can get it sent to your house for free. And I think that would help me because the constant quest of myself and my publisher is to get into bookshops like Barnes & Noble and places like this. And the only way you can do that is to have a consistently high Amazon standing. So that's what we try to to try to aim for.
Webster, this book, this George Bush, the unauthorized biography should be in every history class in America.
Very kind of you to say so. I think it may be in some, but I don't think it's in all of them quite yet.
Okay, well, look, all I know is when we were reading about the Red Studebaker, I saw all kinds of literary attributes you also have in terms of wit. And I like a good wit. When I read, I like to hear just as sharp a wit on our side, the truth side of things, as you get from mainstream, you know, heroin-clad whatever, you know, junk news.
Well, I think one of the problems is that we have these neocons, right? We have this tribe of neocon fascist madmen who are running things.
Yes.
And they're really rather dull. They don't have much of a sense of humor.
Apparently not. Apparently,
it doesn't dawn on them.
They didn't like the unauthorized autobiography of George Bush Sr., where you were what people don't realize about you is that you were here almost a generation ago doing what people are now discovering to do. And you were writing about the connections with the Nazis and the, you know, Prescott Bush and all that. And a lot of the information that gets requoted on the net is from you, but they don't know it's from you.
I think this book, the 1992 unauthorized biography, is the source of the connection of the Bush family with Nazism, with Hitler's seizure of power, with Hitler's rise to power. And it documents how in 1942, the Alien Property Office of the United States government, as a war measure, confiscated, seized property of Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current tenant of the White House, and because it was a Nazi bank, in effect, the Union Banking Corporation. Prescott Bush was on the board, and he was a shareholder, and they took his stock away, at least for the duration of the war. He got it back later. It was worth millions. And this was a bank controlled by a man called Fritz Thyssen, who had written a book, I Paid Hitler. And he did pay Hitler. Without Thyssen, T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, it would have been impossible for Hitler to come to power. So that's the kind of people you're dealing with. You can't take anything off the table when you're dealing with madmen and reprobates of this type.
Yeah, and that reprobation begins, you know, in the soul. It's in the mind. It's the, you know, people go the satanic way. They get a taste for this sort of thing, war, death, pain, inflicting. You know, they don't care about other people. That's another thing that happens.
Absolutely. And if you look in that 1992 Bush biography, it has a pretty healthy chapter on Skull and Bones, which could only be described as a death cult. It seems to be organized
absolutely.
Around actual human remains, bones that they steal and keep in their crypt, and they have a whole satanic ceremonial that they go through. Mm-hmm. So yes, this is the kind of people who are now in power, a kind of bankers, Freemasonic, pro-British, royalist kind of group. And they have their satellites, including people like the degenerate emir of Dubai. When people say the ports are going to go under the control of the government of Dubai, make no mistake, the government of Dubai means the emir. And my research as of about 1990 was that this was a family that had slaves, literal human slavery going on there.
Yeah, slave trade is still going on. The gun trade, slave trade, drug trade, all these are interrelated. It's a vast criminal network of which the head, I guess, some of the neocons that you see and some that you don't are really at the head of all this. And people, you know, Webster, a lot of people just feel powerless with all this. They say, well, yeah, maybe Webster's right, and maybe his books are a must read, but I can't deal with it anymore because I no matter what I think, they keep going forward.
Well, there's always something to do. And if just to jump ahead to that, I'm going to describe, I hope, in the course of our hour, the constellation that indicates that war, a wider war in the Middle East with Iran, is definitely on the agenda for now, for these weeks, these months. We should mention something about the Iran oil bourse as one of the causes of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want all of this, the one thing that I recommend is take the September 11th issue and make that explode. The theory behind it simply is this. Bush has a solid base of support of 35% to 40% of this population. He seems to be bumping along at the lower end of that scale right now, but it is a grave mistake to think that he's going to lose that support unless something very serious gets done on September 11th. Remember that with his demagogy of terror, Bush has been able to terrify, literally scare senseless, more than a third of this population to the point where they sincerely believe that he's their protector against dark forces who want to kill them. And unless you address that, everything else fails. You can't make any argument on Iraq. Bush doesn't. Bush makes a 9/11 argument. You can't get anywhere with Abu Ghraib or torture or renditions or secret CIA prisons or even civil liberties in many cases, because these people are just scared senseless. And the only way that they're going to see the light is to see 9/11. Karl Rove has already said that September 11th is going to be the issue for that gang this year, 2006, in the same way that it was in 2002 and 2004. And we have the lily-livered, chicken-hearted Democratic Party who are running to prove that they're more devoted to the myth of 9/11 than Karl Rove is. And, of course, what I try to show in that book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, is that it is an inside job. It's a provocation coming from secret government networks in the CIA, in the Pentagon, in the intelligence community more broadly. And the Arabs that you see, the Attas and so forth, and the Bin Ladens, for that matter, and the Al-Qaedas, these are simply patsies. These are simply controlled or manipulated assets, manipulated through organizations like Able Danger, which is the reason that Able Danger had to know everything that these people did, was to see if they were following orders, to see if they were on track to do what they were supposed to do in order to be implicated and scapegoated. You got to attack this. And if you do that, you can break the hold of Bush on a significant part of that base. The ports issue opens the door to this, but the ports issue by itself also will not take away the terrible, paralyzing fear that so many people have. So if you want to do something to try to stop the Iran war, or to stop really just about anything else you don't like, be it the ports issue or anything, the 9/11 issue is the key. And I think this is the failure, not just of the Democratic Party, of course, but also of a whole series of left gatekeepers and right gatekeepers who want to sound very radical and attack Bush and don't like the war and don't like the police state, but they accept the premise of all of this. They accept the fountainhead from which it all flows, and that's 9/11. So I urge people, get active on 9/11. Talk it up any way you can. Bombard the corporate media. If there's a radio talk show, call in, do something. Stir the pot. You can always do something. And I urge people to do it right now, because if we're looking for a deadline, I would propose the 20th of March. The 20th of March is when the Iran oil bourse opens up, and that is going to be the beginning of the end, at least, of the post-war hegemony of the U.S. dollar, which I think, on the whole, for us here in this country, would be a good thing. It would be good for jobs, good for employment, good for everybody's economic perspectives here, except for a tiny group of financiers. But this is now coming up, and then that's, I think, why we have this escalation on Iran.
Yeah,
so
it's going.
Should we dive in on Iran?
Well, I just think it's going so fast, as you said, you know, and people have been saying the oil burst, that's coming out. So therefore, we have to get the rhetoric up and get to the point where we can attack Iran. And Webster, what would it mean now, at long last, if in fact around the 20th we attack Iran? What, play through a little bit, what would that mean?
First of all, let me say it doesn't have to come quite so soon. I think the notion would be the U.S. is trying to get economic sanctions in the Security Council. If you just look at the past couple of days, you've had direct threats of war.
Yes.
Coming from Bolton, coming from Cheney, coming from Rice, coming from Rumsfeld, also coming from Shaul Mofaz, the Israeli defense minister. So they're all getting into the act. And then, of course, the Iranians respond in kind, saying that they're also capable of inflicting a great deal of pain. And this is going to be a cataclysmic, catastrophic war for the world, a much wider war in the Middle East, and the beginning of something that we haven't seen in a long time. If you go back in European history, I think the closest parallel, I'm afraid, is May of 1618, that famous defenestration of Prague back there, which probably not studied too much, but that was the beginning of the 30 Years' War,
which
engulfed all of Europe and was, by all odds, the worst war that there has ever been in European history. It killed approximately one-third to one-half of the population of Central Europe. World War One, World War Two don't even come close. This is whole orders of magnitude beyond the world wars of the 20th century. And that, I think, is what's in the works. The neocons have a complicated motivation. A lot of them are facing jail time. Lord Conrad Black has been indicted. Richard Pearl may be indicted for his malfeasance and nonfeasance on Lord Black's board. You've got Scooter Libby indicted. You've got possible indictments against Ledeen for forging the Niger Yellowcake documents that are behind the Valerie Plame story. You've got other neocons who may be called to account, like Feith and Luti, for their lies and fabrications in the Pentagon Intelligence, the Office of Special Plans. So there's a kind of apocalyptic mood, Götterdämmerung, the twilight of the neocon gods, that's spreading among these people. And naturally, if you go to a neocon and say, you as an elitist, what do you prefer? Do you prefer World War III? Or some of them would quibble, say it's really, they would call it World War IV. But I think once it starts, it'll be clear that it's World War III. There hasn't been anything like it in the meantime. They go to a neocon and say, which is better, you go to jail or World War III? And they'll take World War III or World War IV every time.
It's almost a Dr. Strangelove option at this point.
Absolutely. And indeed, Dr. Strangelove, you can say that he is a kind of a caricature of a series of people, of Kissinger, of Posoni, of people like Albert Wolfstetter, who are some of the founders of the modern neocons, the Rand Corporation, doctors of death, right? The merchants of death, the guys who go around with notebooks labeled "World Targets" in Megadeth.
In Megadeth, kind of as George C. Scott had.
Right out of Dr. Strangelove. So they have personal motivation. They feel that they're going down. Their faction is discredited. A couple of them have even jumped ship, right? You've got Fukuyama coming out, the end of history man, saying that he was all wrong, that neoconism is a failure, it ought to be pulled down, that Iraq is a failure. So he's trying to escape the Nuremberg noose, so to speak. This is pretty much what Thyssen did himself, right? That book by Thyssen, I Paid Hitler, was an attempt to sort of separate himself from Hitler, and by and large it worked. You've also got William F. Buckley of the National Review, who was a great supporter of the Iraq War, now saying this was a terrible mistake. So too bad. That's one dimension. At a more serious dimension, you've got this Iran oil bourse, and I think this is a very, very big thing. The domination of the U.S. and the British in the world is based on the dollar. This is the ultimate foundation of everything else that they do. They use military power in the short run here and there, but if you look at the structure of this empire, it's based on financial arrangements, not military occupation directly in the majority of cases. So they've got to have the dollar, and they've got to have the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, used by the international lending institutions like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. Central bank reserves have got to be kept in dollars. There's something like $3 trillion dollars worth of those, although only about two-thirds are actually in dollars at this point. And they've got to have the main raw materials like oil, but also others, strategic raw materials, have to be marketable in dollars pretty much only. There has been some tendency to get out of the dollar because it's a wasting asset. It goes down and down and down if you hold them. The North Koreans dumped the dollar. The first one to dump the dollar was Saddam Hussein back in 2000. Syria has dumped the dollar in the past month, and Iran is now in the process of going beyond dumping the dollar, which also Venezuela has done in other ways. This is not just one country dumping the dollar for its own direct government to other client oil sales, but it's a market where anybody in the world can come and buy and sell oil using euros, not dollars. Now, that would probably lead to the transfer of at least hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion or so, out of the dollar and into the euro, into the yen, into gold, into other assets. And if you do that, if you take as much hot money as that out of the dollar, then you've got a dollar collapse. You're looking at a just a crash of the dollar on international markets, where the dollar would start sliding and never stop, getting down to, you know, minus 60%, minus 75%, minus 90%. Nobody knows how far it would go. It would probably overcorrect even a little bit because of the way this crisis has developed. So
we're right up against the wall, aren't we? In other words,
and you see, this is the contrast is,
wow,
that we've got bubbles going, right? We've got a dollar bubble, we've got a U.S. securities bubble, we've got a housing bubble,
yes,
we've got all kinds of bubbles. At the same time, we've got Ford, GM bankrupt. You've got the baby boomers beginning to retire. They're not going to pump money into the stock market and mutual funds. They're going to start taking it out. You put all this together, the United States, with a $750 billion trade deficit and a budget deficit, just in the federal budget, of approximately the same, about $750 billion, the United States needs to borrow about $1 trillion per year. And what we're talking about is not $1 trillion coming into the dollar. We're talking about a short-term or medium-term exit of about $1 trillion from the dollar, if people could begin to use their dollars to buy some euros and then buy oil, they would begin getting out of the dollar, and that would be absolutely destructive. Right? You can look on the internet and find all kinds of academic economists who say, oh no, that wouldn't make any difference for the demand of dollars. It would make a huge difference, a colossal, tremendous difference, because you're dealing, of course, not with a normal currency, but with a very, very sick currency. So they feel they've got to head that off. And then, of course, you've also got this thing with the Iranian atomic research, nuclear research, which I think is largely a red herring. I think this is, as far as anybody can see, if there is such a program, it only leads to a nuclear device, not even a bomb, but a device, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. That, again, would be a device. It might not even be deliverable. And then it would only be one or two. Now, Israel is estimated to have something like 500 nuclear weapons, and they've got them on ballistic missile submarines. They've got them on bombers, on missiles. They've got their own anti-ballistic missile program, anti-missile missiles they've got. And so this is, you're supposed to think that a couple of atomic bombs in the hands of Iran are going to change the course of world history. This is just crazy. This is overstated to the point of being absurd. And, of course, the people who are telling you this are precisely these neocon fascist madmen, the greatest liars of the age, who have, you know, they've just taken a time out from their lies about Iraq, and now they're back with new lies about Iran, and the goal is always war. So
yes, it's very much the same thing as it was in 1990 or whatever, you know, with the pre-Gulf invasion. You know, Saddam's a madman. He's got weapons of mass destruction. We've got to get those weapons away from him. It's imperative. He's now invaded Kuwait. It's imperative that we get, you know, because we're going to find in those bunkers big caches of, everyone thought he had nukes, lots of nukes. They thought he had, chemical and biological weapons that could wipe out half the globe. And so we got to get him, you know, and now the same thing with, Ahmadinejad. We got to get him because, look, he's building a nuke, and we can't, you know, Israel is at risk, and the Western, you know, societies. So many people I'm friends with that I thought we were on the same page are now starting to get worried about Iran. In other words, the mind control, Webster, is working on them. They're starting to change. They're starting to get the idea that they don't like Iran currently.
I think we're dealing with a mass brainwashing campaign,
yes,
with a new dimension of the demagogy of terror.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there is no proof of any of this. If
right.
anything, the proof is that the people telling the stories are the great discredited liars of the past 15 or 20 years, as you say. I think, again, the only arguments that ultimately undercut this, it is not enough in these affairs to stand on the defensive and refute every lie one by one. You've got to go on the offensive yourself,
mm-hmm. yeah.
attack, and the only way to attack is the people telling these stories are the authors of 9/11. They are the September criminals, the September criminal regime which is in power, which is running the government, right? Which does run Bush. It puts the speeches in front of him that he reads, and it includes Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condi and the rest of this cabal.
I read a little bit of it from 9/11 Synthetic Terror, must read book, Webster Griffin Tarpley. You can get it. You can get it from the publisher or Amazon.com. But basically, everywhere you turn in this book, every page we read a little bit in the first hour, just how Cheney consolidated, 47 some odd agencies under his control. and then of course we have the whole Patriot Act problem where you if you disagree, you get, the building is evacuated because of a nerve agent scare. Remember that.
Oh, we've just had that a couple of times here. It doesn't get the attention that it needs anymore. But one of the Senate office buildings was evacuated over a so-called nerve gas scare, just in the past month or 6 weeks. The only thing I would say about Cheney is, remember, Bush and Cheney are both puppets.
Yes.
Cheney is a rather higher level puppet than Bush, but he's a puppet. And if you want to see the strings, they go to the hands of somebody like George Shultz, who picked Bush, picked Cheney, picked Wolfowitz, picked Condi, picked Schwarzenegger. And, of course, Schultz doesn't do these things because he's the dictator of the United States. We have an oligarchy, and what we have traditionally is people who emerge as spokesmen for the oligarchy, and I think Schultz represents that. If Schultz told Cheney that he should resign today, Cheney would resign today. And through Schultz, we sort of, it's difficult to follow it further, although you can follow it somewhat further. Those are the links then that lead to the actual invisible government itself, which is largely financiers with soldiers, diplomats, and spooks working for them behind the scenes.
And
with the British playing a tremendous role. The British are always in the center of all these activities.
Yeah, and it just, the picture you paint, Webster, is so absolutely... it's a devastating picture, and there's so much. There are other people besides you out there. I mean, I just saw a film by Dylan Avery, Loose Change. I recommend that one, where he just goes through the facts, very gingerly, step by step, that anyone could understand. You, Webster, go through the history, and it just seems that it's obvious at this point that if you can just start, like you said, with 9-1-1, with just any fact at all about, okay, controlled demolitions, the firemen could put it out, there's no building that could burn at that high of a heat to collapse it, just things, just the physics of it, it would lead to indictments.
Of course, and the way that I proceed, is as you point out, is not quite this one. I do get to many of those facts. I hope most of them, enough of them to make the case.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, when you have something like 9/11, it's a very big operation. It implies colossal resources, tremendous amounts of money, people. It involves suppressing the air defense of the United States for more than 1 hour and 45 minutes. As compared to the Cold War standards of 5, 10, or 15 minutes at the very most.
Right.
To get planes in the air, or the Payne-Stewart standard, which was something like that.
Oh, that was weird. I mean, that was very strange. Do you have any insight on that Payne-Stewart?
No, and I don't know any, it's only useful to me as an example of how they could have echelons of fighters ready, two per base, for a series of bases over 1,500 miles, so that there was always an escort around this plane, and this was done within less than 20 minutes. So in 1999 for Payne Stewart, it was less than 20 minutes in the first case, and then there was continuous coverage after that, compared to 9/11, where it's more than 1 hour and 45 minutes, from 8:15 when the first plane is hijacked, until about 5 minutes after 10, 10 minutes after 10, when the last plane, or flying object, goes down, because we're not even sure it's planes, of course. You've got at least an hour and 45 minutes. Now, there's no force in the world that can suppress that air defense except a force inside the U.S. command structure. And not only are there drills that promote the weakening of the air defenses, there are other drills that, according to my research, especially in the second edition of my book, that's the second edition, which has come out now in January of 06, just a few weeks ago, practically. You can also identify other drills which facilitate the notion that these operations were conduited through the military and security bureaucracy of the United States, because they are so large and so ambitious that they required the use of government resources in an atmosphere, however, where not everybody in the government is a participant, and some indeed might be opponents if they knew about it. These would be things like Amalgam Virgo, which practiced, for example, how to shoot a cruise missile from a barge or a freighter off the U.S. coast and hit a target on land. I think this is pretty much what happened in the case of the Pentagon, something like that. Or another Amalgam Virgo 02 that was planned, was going to be airliners taking off in Utah or places like this and then ending up in Canada, where the pilots would be real pilots, the hijackers would be FBI agents posing as hijackers, and the passengers would be actors. And I think you can see, therefore, how all of this was prepared. There was probably a sanctioned drill going on, and a double agent like Mohammed Atta thought he was working for the U.S. government, thought he was in a drill, if he was there at all, and then found himself in something quite different when the planes disappeared or blew up or were liquidated or whatever happened to them.
Can you imagine being hired for, you know, if that's your gig, you know, it turns out they're going to kill you? Yeah, pretty dark.
That is exactly what these people are. Like the guy we have on trial here in Alexandria, Virginia, right, Moussaoui.
Mm-hmm.
Moussaoui is somebody who he's probably a fanatic who believed that he was working for Al-Qaeda. In other words, he's a dupe, he's a fanatic, he's a psychotic. But such people have to be led and directed by double agents of the type of Atta, who are much more witting, although not totally witting, and those double agents have to report to a structure. And again, it appears to me that Able Danger, with its mandate of manipulating terrorist groups, is the likely focus for looking for the case officers and the terrorist controllers of 9/11, the people who would tell Atta what to do, and then Atta would tell Moussaoui what to do. And what they think they're doing is drills, primarily, or related activities. At least that's what Atta thinks he's doing. Able Warrior is the biggest yearly special forces exercise of the anti-terrorism divisions of the U.S., but whenever you have a drill like Able Warrior, they always come in these binary pairs. One is playing attack, one is playing defense. So if Able Warrior is the defense, what's the attack? It would be something like something called Able Danger, something more aggressive. And and if you wanted to mimic the attack, you would need a stable of plausible-looking Arab Islamic terrorists so that you could go through the motions in most cases. But at a critical moment, the drill goes live.
It goes live.
It becomes real.
Yeah, we've been through that here already, where certain guests that I've had, one Captain May has talked about, you know, they can just flip. He believes they flipped it live, and they're looking for another event now. Let me get your thought on this. And caller, stay right there. I'll be right with you. For Webster Tarpley, 877-ZEPHNET, 877-937-4638. And we have to get all this information, the groundwork laid down here, folks, so be a little patient with us. What is your thought about another 9/11 event? Do they need that to get things going?
Yes, absolutely. All of my work since last July, August, has been based on the famous article by Philip Giraldi in the American Conservative, where he says that Dick Cheney has told the Pentagon, be ready to attack Iran in the wake of a new 9/11. In the wake of a new 9/11. Now, Cheney, given who he is, and his controllers above all, are not going to sit around doing rain dances waiting for some 9/11 to happen that they can then allow to occur. This is fantastic. If they want a 9/11, they're going to go out and organize it. This also means if anything goes off anywhere in the world, don't look for somebody in a turban. Go to Dick Cheney's office. Look for that guy Addington or these other co-workers of Scooter Libby or former co-workers. They need this desperately. Given the weakness of the U.S. forces, given the logistical breakdown of the U.S. in general now, the only hope that they have is a bombing campaign possibly using nuclear weapons. So they've got to have a pretext which in the eyes of the world will be so colossal and so heinous that they can then proceed to the atomic bombing of Iran out of a clear blue sky. So they're going to need a new 9/11 and or a new Gulf of Tonkin incident. In other words, some of this stuff can take place through terrorist channels, so-called, right? Something that looks like irregular warfare. Or it can be a sneak attack on a U.S. warship that might be carried out by a third country. You can go through an interesting list of third countries. Could be Australia, could be Israel, could be anything. They arrange these things, right? That's what Northwood says. The Operation Northwood's documents mm-hmm. show that the U.S. military, as of 1962, was willing to attack itself and the U.S. territory in order to get the pretext for these activities. So if we say the financiers are screaming about the Iranian oil bust on the 20th of March, the Israelis are screaming about this largely chimerical threat of a nuclear weapon, but they're screaming to be sure. The neocons are screaming that they don't want to go to jail. The invisible government sees their puppet Bush collapsing in the polls. So there's every reason to think that the danger is very high. And I put out a red alert at the right before the Super Bowl that the mm-hmm. time from the Super Bowl to the end of the Olympics and indeed all the way to the 20th of March is a red alert. In other words, we've raised our terror watch, not the official terror watch, but the anti-terror watch.
The anti-terror red alert, meaning for the, you know,
red alert,
people.
Meaning maximum vigilance for the idea that this is the time when they need something to go off, right? You can see that the U.S. effort in the Security Council is bogged down. Condoleezza has said we can't ask for economic sanctions right away. That means that they fear that Russia and or China will veto such a thing. And that's probably correct. So what are they going to do? They need an outside event to take place.
Gosh, okay. Okay, well,
one of the order of things we should just touch on is what happens if they go through with this? Well, in addition to the police state here at home, which I guess goes without saying, the Iranians have this ability, because of that long coast, vis-a-vis the Persian or Arabian Gulf and the mm-hmm. Straits of Hormuz, they can interdict that. I remember in 1987, 88, there was simply a bunch of mines, floating mines, that the Iranians unleashed in the Gulf. And this led, as you recall, maybe to this, practically the breakdown of tanker traffic. Not that the ships were being destroyed, every one. Not everyone was destroyed. Some were. But the main thing was the insurance rates, that once the insurance rates go to a certain level, the oil transport is no longer profitable. So we can expect the Iranians to interdict that entire stretch of ocean with mines, with torpedoes, with patrol boats, with sunken hulks in the Straits of Hormuz to block it, with oil slicks, burning oil slicks, missiles. They've got silkworm, sunburn, exocet, you name it, with simple artillery, tanks parked on the beach could have a tremendous effect. And so on and so on. And one of the things that is interesting is that if such a war occurs, it will probably lead to the overthrow of the Saudi Arabian regime as well as to our dear friend, the Emir of Dubai. And I think
well,
you can
we began
see why Israeli circles think this is a wonderful idea, even though this it will be accompanied by, naturally, missiles directed at Israel, missiles directed against bases in Turkey, maybe even bases as far away as Italy, I don't know. It's unfortunate that the Europeans have joined into a war which is actually a war against Europe, as we can discuss. It's an oblique war against Europe in addition to being everything else. And then the financial aspect, the financial warfare, is that lots and lots of people will dump the dollar, and if there's no oil coming through Hormuz, then the oil price will go not to 100, but 200 or 300 or 500, and we'll have an economic breakdown crisis of a colossal order. So it's a true world crisis that's opening up. Plus, the attitude of Russia, if such bombings take place, there are 3,000 Russian technicians. How many will be killed? The Chinese are bargaining for a long-term oil deal with Iran. How many of their people will be killed? You saw what happened in China just over killing three or four people in the Belgrade embassy back in 1999. You'll have China and Russia seething with hate, gravitating together. You'll have the Eurasian bloc, and that sets the stage for tremendous escalation. So,
and on these shores, well, I don't think he understated that Americans have never really seen war on these shores, but they would, wouldn't they, and to some degree?
Well, if you don't choose peace and you insist on choosing war, then you have to reckon with retaliatory actions. I remember Khrushchev in his speeches about we will bury you. I don't remember any responsible spokesman saying, well, now that he said that, it's time for a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union and we're going to settle this.
Right.
Nope, nobody in his right mind thought this, because it was clear the Russians could blow your head off. The Iranians may not have quite that capability, but they have very significant capabilities. It's better not to find out what capabilities they have. I recommend a negotiated solution. If the United States or Israel feel threatened with Iran, let them negotiate with Iran. Iran will certainly say that they feel threatened by the United States and the Israelis, with good reason. So let's have negotiations, and let's have some kind of an equitable solution. There is a basis for cooperation. But in order for that to happen, a very large number of neocons have to go to jail.
Yes.
They have to be put away for a long time.
And the economic bullet has to be agreed upon how much of a bite we're going to take. You know, the people have to decide, okay, you're going to take this much of a hit on the dollar. You're going to take this much of a hit, the alternative being you wouldn't have New York or L.A. or Chicago or whatever, you know?
Well, I wouldn't put it maybe in such dire terms. I think on that, what you need is a new world monetary system. You need a new Bretton Woods conference, monetary reform. You have the euro, you have the dollar, you have the yen.
Mm-hmm.
What you obviously need is fixed parities, relatively stable fixed parities among the three main currencies. Other countries can then orient towards that. And then you're going to need gold settlement. You're going to need a settling of accounts in gold at the end of a year or whatever agreed on period. And all of that then has to be based on restarting the world economy through high technology exports, gearing up of industry. One of the effects of this dollar system here is that since the U.S. is the buyer of last resort and the universal dumping ground,
mm-hmm.
we don't have any jobs. The place has been deindustrialized.
Yes.
We have no steel industry, no chemical industry.
No tech industry either. That
we
was
have nothing left.
Very
we don't
strong.
Have any oil industry either. They say, oh, Hubbard's Peak, 1970. Yeah. 1970 corresponds to the decline of everything. So it's not surprising that oil should go with it. And it's not a geological fact. It's a fact of political economy. So I would say the point is, if you look at the world today, you've got about 2 billion people that are under a dollar a day if you make that dollar a halfway decent dollar of maybe 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, you've got about a third of the world's population living in abject poverty on the brink of starvation. And ultimately, as long as you have that, the world will never be stable. So I would say the big thing is to address that and to design a monetary system that would stress world economic development. That would mean for the ruling class of the U.S. that instead of printing dollars, they would have to create modern production facilities, modern factories, modern industrial parks, create high-paying industrial jobs, and put people back to work. Because we have had 30 years of declining standards of living. Our living standards are cut in half. We have a tremendous rate of real unemployment, which is never reported. We have a demoralized workforce. We have unions in decline. We have union busting. We have declining wages and the rest of it. And the only way out of that is to shift over into actual production. So I think that ought to be the mainstay of a new monetary system. So what are you going to do? Go out and fight for a dollar system that condemns you to unemployment and $6 an hour wages? I can't see this.
Okay, let's go to a call real quick. This is a very patient human. Hello, you're on the air with Webster Tarpley on the Zeff Report.
Hey, Zeff, I'm used to having to be patient with you. This is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. Jeff Cross, also a guest here. How are you doing?
Hey, Wes, I love listening to your interviews on Rants and Alex Jones. I'm glad you come to Zeff's show.
Thank you.
I wanted to share a little historical factoid with you that you might find interesting. You can put this in the category of nothing new under the sun. You know, as we're about to go into this war between Islam and, you know, the holy Christian empires once again, I found this picture called the Battle of Lepanto, which was this massive naval event that happened back in the 1570s, which basically ended the Islamic dominance of the Mediterranean Sea. And it was between the Holy League, which was like this confederacy under the Pope, against the Ottoman Turks, right?
Well, this holy league, nothing holy about it. The leading power, of course, on the western side, you had the Pope participating. You had this character, Don Juan of Austria, who was leading the Spanish fleet. But mainly you had the Venetians. And the Venetians, of course, and this is something that I've studied at great length. It's actually my specialty as a historian. The Venetians are the experts in manipulating everybody. They ran it left and right. As you can imagine, the whole era of the Crusades is the Venetians playing Europe against the Arabs in order for the greater glory of Venice, so that Venice could survive long after it otherwise could not have. So that was my reading on Lepanto.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because in the painting you see the major colors of the two fleets, the symbols. And one, you know, the Ottoman Turks is the crescent, right? But the other one of this quote-unquote Holy League is the double-headed black eagle, which we find in, you know, Freemasonry and every other dark corner of power in the Western world. It's just an amazing historical parallel.
Well, I think the most dangerous, though, is the Venetian lion, the Lion of St. Mark. You can see this lion all over Venice and all their iconography and iconology. That lion has got one foot in the water, one foot on the land, and then he's got this plaque that talks about the Gospel of St. Mark. But that is, that's the symbol of oligarchy, right? Venice is the superpower of intelligence, of manipulation, and oligarchy. And again, the Venetians are, they're largely atheists. They don't care anything about religion. They care about religion as a tool of political manipulation. And that's exactly what the neocons more or less say that openly. They say, well, you know, we have to have religion for the masses, right? We have to drug them with it. That's the neocon approach to religion. So the neocons are a bunch of atheists who believe in the use of religion for duping people politically. And that's pretty much the Lepanto story once again.
Hey, Wes, I got one more question for you.
It's Webster.
Webster, I'm sorry. I heard on another talk show that Taiwan Semiconductor is one of the exclusive, or maybe the exclusive manufacturer of nanotechnology related to computer chips, and that the Pentagon has contracts with Taiwan Semiconductor, and if China, Red China, were to invade Taiwan, we would lose that incredible asset for, you know, supercomputers and other applications. Do you know anything about that at all?
No, at the time of the Iraq War, I had a list of 10 items or so that were all vital military technologies that were no longer manufactured in the U.S. They were coming from Europe, from Japan, from Taiwan, and it was a pretty healthy, pretty decisive list. With all of those countries, if they wanted to, they could shut down the U.S. military machine just about overnight. On Taiwan, I think the most important thing about Taiwan right now is the president of Taiwan, this guy from the Democratic Progressive Party, the Green Party of Taiwan, has absolutely gone off the deep end. And he has said that he is going to abolish the long-term unification commission that the Republic of China on Taiwan had vis-a-vis the People's Republic of China, the mainland. And it means that you now have a madman in the Far East who is much crazier than Kim Jong-il. And this is now the president of Taiwan. And he's saying, well, we haven't declared independence yet, but we're going to take some more steps towards independence. And this, of course, leads to the possibility of something really apocalyptic. If you look at Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, his scenario for World War III starts with China, Taiwan, right? Taiwan declares independence and the mainland attacks. So if we're looking for madmen to watch, it's not just the Middle East and it's not just Northeast Asia, but it's now Taiwan too. This president of Taiwan, the current one, the puppet.
Yeah, and all the shipping that goes through that Philippine, China, Taiwan strait there.
Well,
yes, exactly. I mean, it's one of the most dynamic economic areas of the world, and now you've got a person in there who's a madman. My suggestion to Taiwan is they ought to say to the mainland Chinese, let's make a deal. We accept in principle that we're going to become part. We're going to have a reunification of China in 100 years. We accept it in principle. This is based on the Chinese long view, And I bet they would. I bet the mainland would accept it.
Well, Webster, has anyone ever suggested that you be in power somewhere in politics? I mean, you know, because I almost hit my applause button a couple of times here. You know, I was getting excited about your solutions to a lot of, I mean, to an impending situation where, and I think Jeff would agree with this, where we are looking at our own possible extinction or way of, at least of the way of life that we've had for, you know, this paradigm we've had versus, you know, a more reasonable idea of negotiation and then reordering the monetary system so that we could then stabilize the world economies. What's wrong with that?
Everything's for it. If you look at Christianity talks about love your neighbor, talks about good works. That means economic cooperation. If you look at Islam, they talk about social solidarity, the need to give everybody a standard of living. If we look at Confucianism, which I think is really the underlying view of China and Japan and that whole area, Confucius talks about benevolence. In other words, I guess that's close to charity. Christian love, similar. Leibniz certainly thought so. And then you've got this famous quote from Confucius where he sees this big mass of people and his disciples ask him, if you have a lot of people, what should you do? And he says, the first thing is make them prosperous and the second thing is educate them. So there's a broad platform for rejecting this insane fascist concept of the clash of civilizations, the war of civilizations, which is, after all, the goal of 9/11. Was designed with that in mind, and instead a pacification of the world based on economic cooperation, which is in everybody's interest.
Right, prosperity, and with that comes education and wisdom. Which
and the great lesson of the 20th century is that war is not only futile, war is suicidal.
Yes.
For those who start it, for those who undergo it, war in any form is to be avoided. It's absolutely the last resort. And for the neocons, it's always the first resort.
It's the first resort because, as you said, look, when you go reprobate, the wisdom goes out the window. They're really backwards. I say satanic, meaning that it's not just atheistic, meaning or sort of agnostic or neutral in the middle. They don't really believe in this or that. They just want power. No, the mind has to go reprobate in order to have war. In other words, it's completely backwards, i.e. it's not wise. So
the neocons, I would say the neocons and the Skull and Bones characters believe in evil as an independent principle in history, which I don't. I don't think there is independent evil in quite that sense. I think evil exists as a lack of development or a lack of advancement. But for them, it's an independent principle. It's on the same level as good or God or what have you. And they have made up their mind to worship that and to follow that because that's what they find inside themselves.
Well, that's what the tomb's all about. It's the worship of death, the administrators of death. War is big business. Dynasties of death. Culture of death, as you called it, Webster. Jeff Cross, anything else for us today?
No, I would just say that, you know, I fear for my country. It seems like America, as great as it is and as far away as it is from all the other parts of the world, from the two big oceans that separate it, it only seems like this country could go down either through a nuclear war or if it was controlled from space somehow, and it seems like the architecture for that is just being put in place every day, and I don't know how that's going to factor into this war, but it ain't pretty. But thanks, guys, and thanks, Webster.
Thank you. Okay.
On that, I tried to point to this example of a 30 years war. In other words, a period of warfare that goes on, that even sometimes sputters to a halt after big explosions, something over a period of many years, even decades. The neocon doctrine seems to have something to do with Trotsky's permanent revolution, and therefore they would seem to embrace the notion of endless warfare as the only means of maintaining a hierarchical, plutocratic, oligarchical society of the type that we have now, with themselves in relatively privileged positions.
Yeah, of course. Let's go to another call. Hello, you're on the air for Webster Tarpley on the Zephyr Report.
Okay, Mr. Tarpley.
Yes.
I have two questions, and while I've been waiting, well, you've kind of answered them partially, but why does the oligarchy or whoever, you know, the Illuminati or whoever, why do they want all the wars? Are they just crazy? I mean, are they just so full of the devil? You know, a person is full of the devil. He's self-destructive. He's destructive. You know, in the long run. But
well, as Webster said, they're apocalyptic, sir. At this point, they have an apocalyptic mentality. You know, they it's a kind of Hail Mary time. You know, pastime. Okay, so.
Well, okay, now. Okay, but now. The second thing that I want to point out is that everybody is evil that is not in Christ, and to a certain degree. I don't care how great their character is or how wonderful their motivation seems to be, and how solution orientated they are, how right they are. They're still going to be evil. And a lot of people can't understand that, but that's the truth. And I think that...
You're saying that people that are really, for real, in Christ, meaning they would not start a war. They would be have the spirit of peace of the Lord.
Well, right. And the other thing is, they would not be...
They wouldn't be in politics, probably.
Well, what I'm saying is a Jew... who is not saved, who is not does not know the Lord, does not know Christ as his Messiah, is just as evil or more evil than a lot of other people.
Well, I think we have to agree that evil is in the flesh, and we are in the days of evil. But right now, caller, we're right at the end. I got to get Webster some time to get his books. Thank you for the call, and I don't think we have time to really get that answered right now.
I would just say, I tried to touch on this before. I think there's an ample basis of cooperation with all persons of goodwill. It's purely secular, if you like. It's based on mutual advantage, cooperation, world economic development, world pacification, the avoidance of war, the love your neighbor part. Love God is
I think that's
you.
The idea, you know, when he says being Christ, I think that's only... Really, at this point, there are some of us who believe, and I'm among them, that really God has to bring about a solution. There is God. He is real. He is a person. But it's too big of a discussion. We've been in a geopolitical discussion now. I want to stay with that and finish this up. Webster, please let them know, as we have just a couple of minutes here, how to get the books and all that.
Thank you for the opportunity. Again, the two books you may be interested in are primarily 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, published by Progressive Press of California. There's a new second edition, which is just off the press, dated January 2006. It has all the news from 2005, including Abel Danger as the controllers and Global Guardian, Global Storm as the vehicle, Global Lightning, a whole list of the 15-plus maneuvers on September 11th and how those have evolved into the likely war vehicles of 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. And the other one is George Bush, the unauthorized biography. This is the biography of Bush the Elder, right? Bush the father of the current tenant of the White House, the current resident. This was published in 1992, and this is the one that has how Prescott Bush helped to finance Hitler and was indeed part of the concentration camp financial infrastructure. And you can get those on Amazon. You can get a special discounted price, and you also get them shipped for free. And if you buy it that way, that helps me and my publisher to try to convince Barnes & Noble and a few others that they ought to have our book in their shop.
And you all can do that, too, out there. I got to, you know, start the end of the show here. Webster, I want you to hang on. We're going to have the publisher on as well, hopefully, in the future.
Great.
And talk with him and get you back. And I'm just so excited about some of your ideas. Webster, stay right there. And I'll wind the show up. Folks, you've been listening to Channel Z, The Zeff Report. Where I'm at, if you're not in Christ, you don't have it, but I've done some pretty bad things in Christ, amen. There's a lot of, I think we're struggling for a solution. Well, the one thing we don't want to see is, if it can be avoided, a war that completely destroys all the children and all these starving people in the world. There, you know, let's just admit that God has got a plan. He's working to bring it about. We love you. We're praying for you. I'm Zeff Daniel, your host. Sorry I couldn't get to your calls. It just was that kind of day. Next time we'll have Webster back for a Q&A. We love you. We're praying for you. And I had someone request this song earlier today, so I'm going to play it at the end. And we'll see you tomorrow. Happy anniversary, baby.
Any day now, hope it can reach me when I'm way down. One love, one God, and I'm okay now. 10 years off the left.